the reality is that being trauma-informed means we have the ability, the skill to interpret people's behavior and understand that trauma has been a variable that has impacted the way their brains and their bodies work. These are awesome people that have chosen long ago to be part of the solution. And how do we appreciate and connect with that?
I got to say this, just this one thing. When someone else comes up to you and says, I do trauma-informed care, if they don't have an answer like that, they're Yeah. Like that's actually trauma-informed care. And nobody actually knows what that term means. And that's the big difference.
Welcome to the No One Fights Alone podcast. This podcast is dedicated to mental wellness for first responders and beyond. Through powerful stories, personal experiences, and expert insights, we explore the challenges and triumphs of maintaining resilience in the face of adversity. Together, we remind you, no one fights alone.
Hey, welcome back to the No One Fights Alone podcast. We're running hot today. We're just going to roll with the flow because I have co-host Ben Pearson and our old friend Austin is back. Man, it's good to see you on here.
Here to ruin the episode.
Shut the hell up. It's good to have you back. How's everything in Utah?
Warming up, man. That's the thing that matters. It's like 63 degrees today. That's the most important thing in my life right now is to see sunshine. Oh,
man, 63 in Utah. That's got to be in Midway. Yeah. That's got to be nice.
Oh, yeah.
It's way nice.
It's a good change up. The golf course is open. Also, it's coming. Golf season's coming.
I'm ready. Yeah, for sure. It's got to be, we've been getting stormed on like crazy here in Oklahoma, but man, the weather's been nice and fixing to do a little traveling again. Ben and I are fixing to kick off a big LA training starting probably, what is that, about 5 weeks? 5 weeks, I think. We're less out from big training gig in LA.
4 weeks from today.
4 weeks from today.
Well, 30 right. days. Yeah. No, we're June. Yeah. June 2. Yeah. We're out there.
June 2.
Yeah. Not that you're counting down.
Big deal.
Or anything, right?
No, I explained to my kids last night. They're like, it's one of those, my kids and I, we're going to Philadelphia here in a couple of weeks for my daughter's graduation. And they're excited about being on a plane. They're like, man, how many times have you been on a plane, Dad? Do you think you go on a plane again this year? I'm like, Dad's going on at least 10 different plane trips.
Yeah.
No, that's, I guess, 20 different planes. But yeah, we got a full year of travel and stuff ahead.
Dad will end up buying new luggage this year.
That's
how that's going to go.
I got Dad points for that.
That's a good testament as to how often you travel.
Yeah,
for sure. Well, fellas, I'm kind of excited about this podcast. I'm more excited about the content of what I want us to talk about today. We've been talking around the fact that Chateau needs to grow, and we are growing. Chateau Health and Wellness Residential Treatment Facility, we're growing. We've been talking about this for a long time, but today's podcast, we're just going to talk all the ins and outs of it as of today, as of the recording, which is May 2, it's happening. We're in the middle of it. We're growing, licensures and contractors and headaches. And, I mean, it's all there, remodel. And so I would love to just like pick both your brains. You two are, and Danny, are the ground floor of the brains behind making all this happen. And I think I get a lot of questions out there about what this growth looks like. And we haven't really done a formal podcast on this. I'd love to take the opportunity to do that. So Ben, let me just throw out a generic question. Tell us just big picture what is happening. Just overall theme. And we'll get in the weeds about kind of ins and outs of it. But
okay, cool. As far as big picture, we're making a leap. The size of the facility is probably the biggest news. We've been at 16 beds and have kind of pushed the edges of our abilities for the last few years. It's been awesome to see the amount of trust of different agencies from all over the country that have put in us. We've had loads, you know, hundreds of great experiences at the facility. And, you know, over the last 2 years, we've had to delay, schedule out, and sometimes, not be able to work with different people. And so the demand of you know, the good news that's kind of getting out there is there is hope, there is possibility, there are some answers for folks. And now we're going from 16 beds to what will eventually at capacity be 56 beds. So a chunk of that is going to be a detox, and the other that is just residential beds.
That is a lot. That is growing from 16, well, licensed for 18 beds currently, to a 56 bed capacity. Austin, how about just logistics and I mean, where are we going? Like what happened? How did we, what facility did we find? Like, where is it? What does it look like?
Yeah. So caveat there, we will not be going to 56 beds anytime soon. Like there is a small caveat in there of like, yes, of course, we will be increasing space, but we will not make the drastic jump to that immediately for a number of reasons. You know, one.
Yeah, I think we'll get into that. I think we'll get into why we're doing that. I anticipate that conversation. So, yeah, thanks. Great point.
Yeah. Quality. Let's start there. That was the number one. But we'll, logistically, you know, Chateau's been up in the mountains a lot of the time, and me working admissions, I'm sure you've heard too, is people refer it as, do you want to go to the beach or the mountains, right? Which some of these first responder treatment centers. And so that was a key point for us, like moving down into Salt Lake, like, sure, that is in the mountains technically, but the rest of us that live here say that's the valley. And a lot of people, not a lot of space. So, you know, realistically, it was really tough for us, and we spent years looking for something that was going to keep the same feel that we have with a higher capacity of people. And so we found...
Now, when you say feel, let me explore that a little bit, because I've been there. I understand what you're saying, but let me see if I can draw that out. When you say the same feel, maybe for people who haven't been to our current facility, what... Maybe describe that a little bit, because I think you all did a great job of matching up the feel as you're referring to it.
Yeah. Current space, like, I mean, it's on a golf course. It's in a pretty secluded neighborhood-esque type feel. You can walk outside. You're not hearing a bunch of cars going by. There's no locked-in gates that makes you feel like you're just in, you know, some type of jail. It feels very free. The air is nice. You look out both east and west. You see huge mountaintops. You can see snow a majority of the year. You can go for walks. It feels so much more open than something that's just right smack dab in the middle of the city, or even in, you know, a larger town. And so a lot of people, the first feeling that they get when they come through is one of comfort, because they walk through the doors, they can sense that it's just not what everyone pictured a treatment center was going to be. Right. That was a huge piece of it, was like, doesn't feel like a hospital. It's not quite a home either. Cause it, you know, no matter where you go, if you're going to treatment, it's not going to be home. That's just the reality. But there was a sense of it being someplace that won't be extremely uncomfortable from the physical standpoint, right? Like welcoming. Our current facility does have, I mean, it's called the Chateau. I think part of it, the reason why we named it the Chateau 15 years ago was the look of the building, right? Mountain lodge type feel. And so we wanted to encompass that feel wherever we went. That is actually way more difficult than you think it would be.
I bet.
You know, to have a chateau someplace, you know, across the state or even in a different state is really, really difficult to find.
Because you're talking about architecture and design and environmental feels. And I mean, it's all that you're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. And, so, you know, after years and years of searching, we did find we're actually going more rural, which is shocking. Right now, Midway is what, 6,000 people?
Yeah, something like that.
6,000 people. We're moving to a little town about 23 minutes away. called Oakley, Utah, town of about 1,200 or so, give or take, maybe a couple hundred there. Even though it is really close, and it's actually the same distance from Salt Lake City as we are, it's actually more in a secluded area. You're walking outside, you're feeling, you know, the mountains, you can see. It's actually more farmland-esque than this is. This is like golf course kind of gated community feeling that this Oakley facility is more. Mm-hmm. There's a wide open pasture right next door. There's a little stream that runs through the property. You walk outside, you get to see the mountains. The air is crisp and clean. And the facility itself is exactly what we wanted in the mountain lodge feel. Huge high ceilings when you walk in, big timber beams. Like, you feel like you're coming to a ski resort in a way. Like, that is what
big stone fireplace.
Yeah, big stone fireplace. And, you know, it's definitely not what you would think. Once again, as far from a hospital as you can be in this setting.
Right. Right. I mean, you can't ignore the fact that we are residential treatment. Yeah. I mean, the obvious is there, but I feel like you guys have done a really wonderful job of selection there. Ben, what does it look like on kind of capacity and how to fill it up? And let's get into the weeds a little bit on this bed count and what's that's going to look like, just kind of operationally.
Sure. Well, I want to follow up with a little bit that Dawson just commented on. There's an element of treatment that is beyond the therapy that matters quite a bit. And I think is, even whether we're geeking out on the clinical research, but there's a lot of evidence out there that says we need to help folks, these responders who are taking a leap of faith and jumping into this unknown path of getting healthier, especially at a residential level. How we help their nervous system kind of slow down and reset is a big part of what treatment's about. I mean, I'll get into some of the quality people, the quality activities, and the kind of interventions we're doing that makes the process impactful. But at the end of the day, how all of us manage our nervous system matters. And part of what he had talked about in terms of the aesthetics of the program has a lot to do with what we're trying to do all day, every day, which is help their nervous system, which is not a traditionally a very conscious process. We might notice colors and people and things like that, but overall, our nervous system, believing that, hey, we're safe, we're taken care of, people give a shit, that happens a lot when you, or our nervous system, especially those that have kind of fried nervous systems, are constantly scanning, looking for potential threats. And as we picked this facility, it's how do we calm that down? How do we make this simple? How do we keep it clean? How do we keep it organized? And how do we get rid of some of the distractions that are out there? I mean, welcome to part of why we don't have clients on their phones or watching TV or doing that kind of stuff. Like, those things typically are creating a little bit more anxiety for our nervous systems when we have that kind of input. So having the horses across the street and having these high ceilings and just having some quiet places to reflect and to connect with people and all that stuff, a lot of it is really about helping their nervous system calm down, because we've all got plenty of tough things to tackle when it comes to therapy. But if overall we don't settle into the reality that I'm okay, I'm safe, that I'm being cared for and connected with, a lot of the therapy doesn't really sink as deep as it needs to. Does that make sense?
I love that you're bringing this up, because the you know, Austin kind of teed that part of it up, and I'm really glad you opened that door, because I think people think that we can just do this about anywhere, but the reality is, if you had our current facility on a busy, you know, 4-lane, 6-lane, or an interstate right next door, I mean, it would have a completely, just that alone,
right, yeah,
would have a completely different set of problems and hurdles and challenges to calming the nervous system, allowing somebody to just be present and not, you know, I wonder what's happening. I wonder, you know, sirens for any first responder, you know, next to an interstate, the frequency of sirens is often. And as soon as you hear a siren, it doesn't matter. It's still, I've been retired 6 years. When I hear a siren, it just takes me somewhere.
Sure.
Not present.
Great point.
So I love that you bring that up. So yes, to your point, again, just continue this kind of this path. Sorry, I interrupted you.
But you're great.
This path of what that looks like, because you guys are giving a great description of the new facility and kind of what's going on there.
I think those sirens, and again, I would argue that our phones sometimes create a very similar experience. This little mm-hmm. buzz in our pocket, even though I think some of our clients are annoyed and all of us really miss our favorite pacifiers of technology. But the reality is that we're really trying to, in a way, that's what we're up against. People who are used to being constantly triggered, wanting different results, even though we're having to ask them to really let go of some of their favorite triggers. And so that's part of, as we get into the services of an average day at the facility, we're constantly behind the scenes is how do we help take care of that nervous system? How do we teach people about it? But how do we connect them with some meaningful activities? So at the beginning and end of all of our days, generally, there is this quiet, calm down, let's check in, let's talk about how we're doing on a really basic level. So those...
I think...
Go ahead.
I was just going to point out, I'm reflecting on, again, still what you're saying about creating this safe environment. I think I will offer up having, you know, kind of some behind the scenes perspective. So I'll offer it up. You, Danny, and sorry that we're missing out on Danny today talking about this, but you two and Danny have had the opportunity to look at facilities in the greater Salt Lake area. And you said no a lot because a lot of this content that we're talking about right here. Is that fair?
Totally.
Years.
This is that important to the Chateau philosophy.
Yeah. I mean, anybody there's places up for sale. Like, let's just be sure the number is a little bit lower in a space like this, but I mean, you can go and find something that's going to, you know, quote unquote work. I mean, this has really been 2 years has been kind of really hard ground running, but it's been a little while longer than that. And there were some that we looked at and passed on, they looked at and passed on. So, I mean, there was a lot of.
So is it fair to say then that the quality of what you're looking for took you a long time to find? Is that fair? I know I'm simplifying a lot here because you guys have been at this for a while. Is that a fair statement? The quality has really burdened the growth.
Yeah. Because they were minutes away from just building something. Like, that's the reality.
Yeah. Like, no, I think that's I think that's a piece of the secret sauce, to be honest. I think people ask, you know, what's the difference and how does that go? I think the culmination of a lot of little details is part of what helps people, hundreds of people, walk away saying they cared, they connected with me, we had the time and the opportunity. So but we'll go into that as well as we talk about the staff and how they interface with our clients. But it is those kinds of things. I think it's absolutely tempting. I'm sure there's other buildings that are cheaper for sure that offer a lot more conveniences. But what we're doing, especially when it comes to the process of saving lives, is we cannot constantly make compromises. Otherwise, we really don't end up getting to where we need to be. And where we need to be is to have someone have a life-changing experience that isn't just, I went to a number of sessions that were kind of bundled together within these kinds of days and these kind of situations. No, the reality is if we're really looking for someone to go against years of training, years of conditioning, years of stigma, and years of this developmental challenge that we're all up against, we need every chance we have in order to have that kind of impact. And so, and I think that's sometimes the difference. I think there's all of us have been to situations or been in relationships where someone's kind of going through the motions, saying the right things on the surface, but their heart's not in it. That's, you know, amplify that to the entire building and the entire staff process. That's really kind of what we're trying to do, is make sure that our heart and all the little variables are in it, so that we can still have that kind of potent, meaningful experience for those who are coming through.
I feel like this may be somewhat of an obvious question, but why grow? I you hit on it, Ben, in, when you first kind of opened this up, but let's open that door a little wider. Why grow?
I mean, a lot of it ends up being about resources. The reality is that, even though, again, podcasts like this have been around for a couple of years, there's been some really cool movement in the first responder world that is trying to build some momentum, but we're just barely scratching the surface as far mm-hmm. as first responders realizing they do not have to die young and they don't have to suffer as much. And when we realize that just scratching the surface, we need more space to, and we need more resources to get out to those folks, whether it's trainings that we try and offer, or whether it's beds that are available, or whether it's, you know, helping clients go home and teach their friends how to be healthy. Like the message, we just have a long ways to go, and we're trying to magnify the impact that we can have. And so beds is a piece of it, but it also means we get to do more dynamic and some different kinds of things that our current facility has kind of just restrict us. We just don't have enough room to do all the things we'd like to do.
Yeah. Office, like I office space, for example. That's a very minute detail, but
it's a big deal.
Yeah, it's a big deal when you have a lack of office space to right. have one-on-one conversations or get, you know, tasks accomplished with case manager or a therapist. Right. Or medical staff, you know, whatever it may be. I mean, that's a very small detail, but like Ben tapped into resources. It's services offered is a big one for me.
Hmm.
There are so many more services that we can offer that go in from a lot of these podcast episodes, whether it's sensory, whether it's different modalities. The amount of staff that we are able to have to train, to accomplish some of these things, it just increases exponentially. Like we have had basically the same staff for 7-8 years.
Yeah.
As far as the clinical portion goes, like there is a portion too of bringing in fresh minds, bringing in new people that can add value to people's experiences. When, mm-hmm. when someone's worked here for a long time, like we have, you know, Knight and Rusty Armor is a great example of something that without Stacy wouldn't have been brought in. And we have the opportunity to bring more people in that have some of those expertise and some of those skills and some of that knowledge that maybe we don't have. We can set our ego aside and learn and then do better.
Such a great perspective. I it's great having both of you on here because you have two. Your perspectives are uniquely different to the same mission. And I'm glad, Austin, that you jumped in there. This concept of being open to new things, is not new to Chateau. We're very open to it. However, I think to your point you're making, we've been very limited on what we can actually do there and limited by, you know, fresh perspectives and fresh minds. I know I'm paraphrasing what you just said, but I want to go back to you on this point operationally, kind of this picture, your perspective, why grow? Why grow? I know in part you just answered that, but I want to get your kind of big picture. Why grow? What I want to hear your 2 cents worth on that.
Yeah. I mean, I also do bring in the I will always have the admissions kind of piece of me. And you know, first off, being an admissions person, and I know that they catch bad raps a lot of the time, duly so. As an admissions person, I hate admissions people, just to throw that out there.
Love
like
you, Colin.
Yeah, it's like those that say a cop's a bad cop, though, right? Like, it's
that's right.
Not a fact. Oh, yeah. And so the amount of people that have began to reach out needing help specifically since COVID has massively increased. You know, nationally, in the first responder space, everywhere. We're in a mental health crisis, and we're going to be in a mental health crisis probably for the next 30 years. The kids growing up that experienced COVID are already having a ton of issues, especially those that were learning to talk and, you know, be functioning humans at a young age didn't get that. So
being in a state of war for the last 20 plus years.
Yeah. Yeah. And yep. So, when you are limited in space and you have to turn people away that are suffering and crying and asking for help, it is an incredibly difficult thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is.
So what we do is we stretch our resources as thin as we can in order to try and service every person we can. Operationally, that doesn't always lead to a great thing, especially for the staff who become tired, who become burnt out, who are stretched thin as it is with their own personal lives and everything they have to do at work, especially in this field. So being able to have more people joining in this effort and being able to service more people are kind of dually combined for me, right? Like, it is one of the most rewarding jobs to have, is to work in this space, but not everybody can do it. Not everybody can do it for their whole career. So, you know, being able to bring more people on to help, obviously get the fresh perspective, to widen resources, to make more space for people to do things, such as sensory work and such as neurofeedback, and, you know, expand on our current services, case management, therapy, group work, experiential therapy, like all of those things just open up a ton for us. And then we can, you know, dump funds into different things like training, preventative work, you know, all of those other things. It is a goal for us to be, for me, because I'll just speak for myself, is to be the leading company in this space for first responders. I think it's achievable. I think there is a gap there that nationally you can become that. But there's no way to complete that journey without doing something like this. It's just a fact.
Well, and we already know we do good work, and there's several facilities across the United States that are doing good work, but we know we're one of them. I when I present, I say that a lot. You know, I don't, and it's not a ego thing for me, because it's not me doing it. It's just me bragging on U2's team, which I think is a good opportunity to segue here to talk a little bit about the people and the staff and just, you know, give our staff some pats on the back and brag on them a little bit. And then what does that look like in growth? Either one of you, whichever one, I want to hear from both of you on this, but what's the magic of our staff and how does that, how do we grow in staff? What does that look like?
Well, when we first kind of put the model together a long time ago, one of the things we recognized is there's kind of a standard out there for treatment early on. And the standard was staff didn't interact much. The reality is that staff are kind of babysitters, kind of transport folks. You kind of wait to meet with your therapist, and you have to wait with whatever knuckleheads next to you.
As long as they go get your phone.
As long as they do shit for you.
Yeah.
I think that's a standard that's been out there for a while. And as Austin talks about creating some leadership in this space, I think it's always good for us to be pushing those standards. Mm-hmm. And so as we talk about developing a culture, and again, back to this experience that our clients have reported back again and again, the a significant amount of time they have in the program is going to be with those staff. And so a long time ago, we decided we need to give more tools and resources to these staff. So not that we're turning them into clinicians, but how do we maximize their impact on the average day and the average experience? I'd love to believe some hokey idea that, you know, my session with a client is going to be the only thing that really makes them think. The reality is, if we do some good work in therapy, most of that's going to manifest hours afterwards, days afterwards, in hours that just aren't very convenient. So having great staff that are there and ready for those little moments, whether it's a teachable moment or whether it's a compassionate, you're doing great. You know, we see hundreds of hard letters being sent from spouses that are saying, I think I'm done. I can't put up with this anymore. And we've got men and women from all over the country that show up and put it on the table and they work hard. And there's some dark moments in between. Mm-hmm. But having a great trained staff member to say, you're kicking ass, hang in there. This is working. You just can't see it. And having a team of folks that can say, hey, the rest of us right next to you, we can see a little bit further than you can. Hang in there. Wait a little longer. Listen a little harder. Do these little assignments. Trust this process a little bit. Having different kinds of voices, different roles in this process that are able to communicate that message and do it in a way that's easy for the client to hear at a time they're willing to hear it, that culturally exponentially changes the amount of therapeutic moments in someone's experience. If it's just this, I have this, you know, this 50-minute window with my therapist, and that's where the magic is supposed to happen. I love and have loved for the last 11 years I've been here that we have an infinite amount of options when you've got great people ready, available, connected to the overall vision of what we're trying to do. And they understand, you know, kind of the mindset and some of the trauma-informed perspective that you need to have for those moments. So the cool part about it is that we see people having dozens of moments over the course of the days that are little miracles and little opportunities. And it's not because of some therapy stuff or even just, you know, the hippie moments, but it's those little moments in between where just someone's there to say, you did it. You didn't think you could do it and you're doing it and keep on doing it. So those are moments that are tough to train, but that's why we take so much pride and time in developing good staff and just good people who want to be part of the solution and helping them connect with some of these resources so that they can be bold when, you know, our grumpy, exhausted first responders go back to what they usually do, which might be ineffective. And we've got someone there to say, let's try it a little bit differently because, you know, days and moments from now, this is exactly the skill you're going to need to use at your home and in your department and on shift. So they just come in all sorts of shapes and sizes, and we got to be ready.
Such a wonderful description of the staff, and I feel like you were talking to program staff, but also you were referencing a lot of your clinical staff because they're in that same space. And Austin, I kind of want to give you the opportunity to look at how difficult it is for a staffer to be that available. Maybe is I'm not sure what the right word there is, but to be the stick and the hug at the same time, if I can be that kind of bold with it. I mean, there's times where you're like, you need to work harder. And there's other times that Ben just referenced of, hey man, you did great. Let's just pause here and, you know, look at how well you just did. How difficult is that? How does our staff do that? I know Ben referenced training already, but, and there's some magic there.
Yeah. I mean, huge. First off, like none of this conversation could be happening without the staff that's coming over. Like, yeah, you're talking to me and Ben and, you know, Danny's a part of this conversation, but realistically on a day-to-day basis, a large percentage of what happens is done by other people, you know, And so to acknowledge the staff that you know, they're the reason the program itself is special or successful or anything is all on them, you know, and to have all of them, we don't have one person not coming with us over to Oakley at the moment. I may be kicking myself later if I say that, but as of right now, all of our staff are going to follow us over there, which is a really cool thing. But, you know, someone tried to make it really simple for me a little while ago when they said, if you want to have accountable staff, hire accountable people. And it's not that simple, although at some points it is. If you ask anybody who has gone through their interview process with us, they will say that it is something like they've never experienced. We had one therapist say, I can't believe this is the most intense and kind of ridiculous hiring that I've ever seen. We do it all the way across. We're not asking you, you know, what time you wake up in the morning, what, you know, your personality color is. We're asking you, what are you interested in? What's your favorite book? Have you ever had these kind of conversations? Do you have podcasts that you listen to? Are there any cool topics that you are involved in? You know, that's how we end up with people that can do the things that they do, is because there is a lot more introspective questions asked of them that we already know that they can accomplish.
Right. And part of what we're looking for is we want to know if our values are aligned. Yeah. I think there are some folks that just love to hear themselves talk, and then they commit their whole careers to working in the service industry. There's loads of folks in this world that just create a lifestyle where people agree with them and tolerate them. And so finding good people that give a shit, that are willing, that know when to teach and when to shut up. That's not all of those are, you know, teachable skills.
That's what I was going to say. I feel like we hire people that come with some of the unteachable skills.
Yeah.
And that means we don't hire everybody we interview by any means.
Yeah.
Right. And
that's, but the large majority of your staff is in recovery as well. I mean, they've kind of been there, done that. I know I'm,
or have a spouse,
you know, yeah. Shortening that.
Yeah. Right. Spouse, family member. I mean, I think that's a huge core piece of working in this particular field, mental health wise, where it's not like a hospital or those kind of things. You know, Ben had talked about something really that has really rang true with me ever since he said it, which is, you know, in your everyday job, you are asked to put all of your personal shit and you leave it at home. You don't talk about it. You show up and then do your job, and nobody gives a fuck what's happening or what has happened to you. Don't talk about it. Do your job while you're here. Here, that is, it's a level of validation that is unlike any other, right? People that have been through something tough or been through something that has impacted them, gives them new perspective and gives them the ability to have conversations with people that you just don't get to have in any other field, right?
Yeah.
You don't get to share experiences. You don't get to talk about victories. You don't get to talk about losses. And that is a very, very powerful thing that people carry with them when they come and work here.
And I think there's an art and there's some real trickiness to that. Yeah. You know, finding people that are personally passionate, but have done enough of their own work to be helpful. I think that,
because you can easily become part of the problem instead of part of the solution.
Oh, yeah. No,
but overshare, over
totally.
You know, of knowing, have enough of self awareness of having be in the pocket of that teachable moment, right, and knowing when to shut the hell up.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I've had therapists before where it's clear, like, I'm here to take care of them. And I've heard lots of responders over the years say, I just, you know, they've been turned off by a therapeutic moment where, to be honest, that the moment wasn't about them getting the support. It was them having to take care of some other person, which is part of the problem. Anyway, so I think the space to train folks to do that kind of stuff takes a lot of role modeling. It takes a lot of opportunities and practice. And yeah, it's a balancing act that, yeah, we take pretty seriously.
I think one of the more kind of, I don't want to gloss over a cultural competency training topic. So I want to hit that as well, because this is important to us and probably those listening. As we grow, maybe we should not ignore the obvious. How do we make sure, because not all of our staff comes from a first responder space, but they're really fucking good at what they do. How do you all get them there? How do you all get them to this cultural competency space of understanding and seeing that there is some uniqueness to our veterans and first responders coming in here?
Yeah, I'd love to take that one. First off, my very first question when we're hiring someone is, do you hate cops? I'm just kidding.
Well, they're out there.
That is a question, not phrased like that. But it is definitely involved in the hiring process. No, there's that comes from the I'm not speaking for me. That comes from the top down in every facet, to where when somebody walks in and they have, you know, our program director training them on how to interact, how to incorporate our program, how to follow our, you know, policies and procedures, all the technical stuff. There's a lot of conversations surrounding that. Ben has not only created a ton of material for our, you know, staff orientation and staff trainings and Joint Commission and state and, you know, all of those type of things, but it is a slow transition for somebody to walk into this space. You cannot unleash somebody on the clients without some strict oversight. I don't know how else to say that.
No.
Because it is not normal. People do not know about the first responder culture. I didn't before I worked here. It's unless you're in it and you got family in it, there's no possible way. So what our goal is to have them sit in some groups, you know, have them be a listener instead of having to, you know, be extremely involved from day one. They have the opportunity to learn. And sometimes that means that this isn't the right job for them. You can find that out very quickly. Someone is not curious about the culture and about, you know, how people talk to each other, how the family dynamics work, how the job dynamics work, you know, what their mindset is going to be walking through those doors. You cannot be successful with this group. And so yeah, there's a lot of training, but that's also on the front end questionnaire of, like, when we're hiring and we're interviewing and we're doing all that stuff, like, it is at the forefront of our minds of, like, are you ready to learn?
I think I'd add to that a lot of the concepts that we employ helps prepare them for this particular question. So as we train someone to be trauma-informed, part of that training is making sure that when people look at someone, they can look at the whole of them. They can see the bigger picture of what's happened, right? I think if we meet someone fresh off the street that cannot see beyond the obvious symptoms, and cannot see that this person is being driven or impacted, at least, by their development, by trauma, their exposure to all sorts of things. If they can't do that, they're not going to do well with a first responder crowd anyway. The reality is that being trauma-informed means we have the ability, the skill to interpret people's behavior and understand that trauma has been a variable that has impacted the way their brains and their bodies work. And when you know that, the reality is you can see way more than before. So when it comes to helping someone who understands trauma and helping them take another step, which is seen another layer of a person, which is a first responder element of it, is that we're helping them see, here's what years of being an awesome professional does. It develops these kinds of skills, and there's a dark side to some of those skills. You get to do this amazing service, have this awesome impact on your community, and you get to develop all of these different kinds of insights and awareness. And here's the dark side of that. But that's human development. We all basically sacrificed some piece of ourselves in order to excel in some areas. And some of us have excelled in protecting ourselves, and that does come at a cost. So as we talk about these new staff coming on board, we help. If they understand that, hey, there's a lot going on in the average person, and there's a lot more to them than whatever label they happen to have in their career or their family situation. When we have a foundation like that, then we get to say, go do your own ride-along. Go connect with some of these responders. Go learn about this culture. And this culture requires hundreds, if not thousands, of hours of development in some of these areas. And the reality is there's a collateral impact that has on an average person. When we get people looking for that, trying to understand that, craving to understand how that world works, you just get to see more and you get to appreciate more. And so they're able, so cultural competence is a little bit about learning about the tactics that people have and about why the average, you know, responder is kind of mission first, emotions 10th. Mm-hmm. And what a challenge it is to help them bridge that gap in order for them to be in a spot where they can save their careers and their families. That's important stuff, but the tactics itself about what these people do at work is really not the heart of the question. The question is going to be more about their values, more about how to humanize this person in general, but it's also about understand where their heart has been in their careers. And when you're looking for that and looking for, here's this person that's given a ton of service. However, for them to develop that kind of situational awareness, it means they've developed some blind spots in some other challenges in other areas of their life. And when you get that, then it's, I'm not trying to catch people doing things wrong. I'm able to see the compassion and say, this is some of the training coming out in this situation. We can see past the training because this person is here literally trying to evolve and grow beyond some of that training and to develop something different. And when you have that kind of gratitude and awareness of what's happening for that person, the reality is that you just interact with them very differently. So I think that's the kind of stuff that matters. So it's a little bit about learning about the life and, you know, ride-alongs and whatnot. But the rest of it really is, these are awesome people that have chosen long ago to be part of the solution. And how do we appreciate and connect with that?
See,
you know, I think pointing out
real quick, I got to say this, just this one thing, because I'm going to forget it. When someone else comes up to you and says, I do trauma-informed care, if they don't have an answer like that, they're fucking bullshitting you. Like that's actually trauma-informed care. And nobody actually knows what that term means. And that's the big difference.
I really am thankful that you brought that up, because that was the comment I was going to kind of lead us down this road, take the long version of this, because I was going to tell a backstory of when I was hired to build a curriculum and do some of the things that I'm doing with Chateau. I ended up calling Ben up and just saying, I don't know if you remember this, Ben, but I said, how about you just let me interview you? There's some things that I'd really like to learn about Chateau that I think you're the brains behind. And I doubt that I'll ever forget one of the most unique statements you made was, we give people extra chances when they've passed the point of deserving it. Now, that may seem a little bit simplified.
Or very codependent.
Right, yeah. But I think for context, I think there's we're out there kind of working in it. There's times where people are just like, dude, I'm done with you. Do your 2 weeks and get the fuck out. Like you check the box. That's all you're wanting. But your staff, under the tutelage and training of both of you and Danny and Lou, we'll give Lou props here as well, because you already referred to it, is to stay engaged with these people to really keep pushing past this asshole facade that they give off in all manner of behaviors and emotion, and really see past, which is the trauma-informed piece that you're referencing, Austin, correct me if I'm wrong here, which is really to see past this, I see you, I see a human, I see a hurting human, and we're going to give you that space, but we're also going to set the bar. We want something in return. We want you to work hard. We want you to heal. We want you to be successful. We want you to be involved and engaged. And I know, Ben, that's oftentimes when I'm bringing people in, that was conversation you have with me is, can he or she participate? Are they going to be involved in part? And this expectation of giving them that opportunity, I think is really important and shows a lot of depth to, Ben, you made reference to the little things matter. This is where it's at. This is what you're referencing. These are the little things that are hard, and you could actually easily walk away from it and say, that guy's an asshole and I'm done with him. But your staff doesn't. They say, you're worth it. You're worth the extra time, the extra fight. And this goes to you two and Danny and Lou of saying, here's the culture we've created. And here's what Chateau, this is really, correct me, Ben, if I'm wrong here, but this is really a lot of the magic of Chateau. Is it not?
I think so. I think that heart stuff matters. There's no way around it. And again, I think there's some research that supports it. There's a research project, I think I've mentioned it before on a different podcast, but the biggest variables for change as far as this research project in the 90s showed, first, do I believe that change is possible? That's a huge chunk of whether or not change is going to happen. The second one is, do I have someone that I can do change with that believes in me? And then together, can we connect with the right kinds of skills to make this happen? And then the one that people talk about the most, ironically, is what comes up next, which is the intervention. So that's why I like this conversation, because I think there's people out there that are shopping around for help and they keep on asking the wrong question, which is, well, what kind of interventions do you do? How often do I get my phone? What kind of amenities do you have? Research has shown those matter the least of those four variables. But having passionate, engaged professionals who believe in you, and you believe that, hey, together we can create something totally different, that's a big deal. So I think, we're still lots of imperfect humans making loads of mistakes. I mean, that's always going to be a thing. But I think that's still one of our biggest values. How do we strive for that? How do we expect change? And how do we plan to join you every step of the way to do it? And that doesn't happen in all relationships.
I feel like we've just kind of answered the how we grow question here a lot. We put a lot to it, but I want to pose that as a question in case either one of you kind of want to talk about that, of how we keep what we just talked about within this culture, existing culture of Chateau, and we do good work, and you all do great work. I just to get to advertise for it. How you all do good work, how the staff does good work, and I feel like we've touched on it, but the how do we grow that to this larger facility? Do you have a kind of a plan in place for growth? Do you have a plan in place for training? Do you have a plan in place for, maybe speak a little bit to that. I mean, and because I think we didn't say we're somewhere between 30 to 60 days mm-hmm. from this change.
Yeah.
I don't remember mentioning that. Maybe I
2025 maybe at
the beginning. Yeah. It's good.
Solid 2025.
Is it even going to be real? It's been talked about for so long. Are we really even going to do this?
2025.
Yeah. It is surreal. To answer that, we're well underway. We've been doing plenty of things for the last year just to get, again, whether it's policies and other organizational things, I think being a small mom and pop shop, there's a certain flexibility of we'll figure it out later. And we have enough people around that we can kind of wing it sometimes. I think this is true with just any smaller organization. And we've been planning for quite a while. So in terms of, I don't know about the logistics, but part of the staffing is probably one of the biggest questions we get is just, you know, how do we have high quality staff that are ready and dependable and do all the kinds of things that a lot of our alumni really are proud of. A lot of that is going to happen in these first few months. You know, we've already been hiring more folks. They get to be here and get to see this and connect with it. You know, we've got interviews today. We'll have more of them next week, but we're trying to find, well, basically what we just described earlier is how do we find the right kind of folks that are ready for that? So bringing them on board, helping them have the mentorship of other people that have been doing this for a while and watching it. They get to benefit from the blood, sweat, and tears of we get to say, hey, don't do this, do more of that. And this is what I learned from. And having a culture that strives to be fairly humble about mistakes we've made, I think that ends up, in my experience, being a more powerful training experience when I'm with a leader who's willing to own, like, this is how we did it wrong, and this is how we'd like to help you this time around. So, for the first while, 2025, it'll be about going from one group to two. And so we've always functioned, the whole house is a unit, and we've functioned that way since the inception. And now we're going to, we have some more space. We have rooms that don't have 25 purposes. we have a little bit of room to kind of spread out, to socialize differently, to eat a little bit differently, even though our goal is to keep people very connected, very engaged. These groups will still function very much together. But we'll have a little bit more walking space to do that. So two functioning units is where we're going to be for the first while. All these numbers about capacity and how big of a building we have, like that's all nice. But our ability to work out the kinks and have these two different teams up and going, making sure our staff see it, connect with it, and them having the opportunity to make the appropriate mistakes. We basically need to make a bunch of mistakes before we're ready for additional growth. And that's important. No shame about it. We need to get in there, take some practice, take some swings and get in there and do that kind of stuff and work out the kinks of it. And down the line, we'll decide whether or not, when we're ready for that additional group. So a lot of it has to do with making sure that our clinical and program staff have enough experience with the systems that we're developing. And then, and to be honest, hearing from our alumni and making sure that we get their feedback of, are we hitting the marks we shot at, you know, we set out to hit.
Yeah. Austin, anything on that?
Yeah, no, I think it's, if you lose the ability to work with somebody individually, you will never succeed. And so the goal is, you know, even though there are more people at the facility, it is keeping the group size and the amount of care that someone gets equivalent. So smaller groups, still the same amount of one-on-one time, same amount of sessions, still have the same ability to do neurofeedback, you know, still have the same opportunity to do our workshops and all of those things together. But instead of 16 people, now you're in with a group of 12 people. Sure, you live with 23 or 24 other people, but your main functioning group is actually still even smaller than it is here.
Yeah.
And you work with the same clinicians, the same staff, all of that kind of stuff. Sure, you may do yoga together, and that's an opportunity to socialize and get to know different things and, you know, everything like that. But your core 40 hours a week is with a group of 10 to 14 people.
Yep.
I know that's a common question out here from everybody from alumni to clinicians to peer team leads to directors, chiefs, sheriffs. it's because there's a lot of people who love the work that Chateau does. So they have a vested interest in this growth as well. And those are our friends and dare say family out all across the United States that say, you're doing great work. How do you maintain this? And I think you both just answered that question really well. So for anybody that maybe is catching up on this podcast as they're driving down the road, if you're looking to have the answer of how the quality of integrity stays the same, back it up about 3 or 4 minutes. And Ben and Austin just unpacked that as well. Guys, I think we'll kind of wrap up. Anything additionally that maybe I didn't ask as kind of we grow and talk about this this growth of Chateau? Anything that we maybe missed or left off, or that you want to add as to the quality of Chateau?
Go ahead.
No, go.
I'm pretty excited about the future. I'm at times a little overwhelmed by the amount of tasks in the moment, but I do think we get to evolve to another level. It's funny, and we've internally joked a little bit because my sweet wife is part of the design team that is making this transformation happen. And the phrase that she uses all the time is
shout out to Ann.
Yeah, shout out to Ann. So she uses the phrase all the time that I probably put in her head somewhere. I'm sure that's my fault eventually. But is that we're growing up. And there's an element I think that is very comfortable and very cool about being kind of the mom and pop shop. We get to be very connected, and I think we get to stay within this humanized theme that we talk about quite a bit. But I'm excited for us to take our own developmental step. It's exactly what we ask our clients to do, is take some risks, grow up a little bit more, own a little bit more, expand a little bit more. And this is our opportunity to participate in exactly that. So it does include some risks, which I'm a little nervous about the amount of scrutiny that comes with change, whether it's our alumni or whether it's our other referrants that are out there. But the reality is, I think it's just that kind of challenge just leads to a better product for all of us. All of us need to have our sights on something a little bit outside of our comfort zone. And so I'm excited we get to do that. I think a year from now, we'll be reflecting on the growth and changes. And I think there's going to be some really cool pushes that helps us do some things we've never even dreamed of.
It's only been 12 years of your life, Ben.
Didn't even notice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's the cool part is just the amount of impact that is possible. But we have no idea at this moment in time what actual impact we can have. And this step gives us an idea of the difference we can make.
Huge leap of faith I think there's some validity behind it. Again, shout out to Ann. I'm going to make a frame something up here because I think she brings up such a great perspective of your growing up. I'll frame it a little bit different. When I first started martial arts, my sensei said, take the time to learn one technique really, really well before you learn something else. And I know this may feel like a little bit of a pat on the back, but I've gotten to watch this from afar. The Chateau team, led by Danny and you two and Lou, you're really good at what you do. And the growth isn't about, it's pretty altruistic about serving the community with the skills and passion that you've nailed down really well. So now we're going to grow that. And I just think it speaks volumes to, this isn't about, this isn't I mean, obviously we don't want to go broke, but this isn't necessarily about the dollar. This is about, can we serve a greater populace of people and maintain the integrity of our program? And I believe you two today answered yes and filled in a lot of the blanks to that. And I just think you guys, excuse me, you two, Danny, Lou, the entire Chateau team, you know, down to the newest, they're all doing wonderful work. I think it cannot be said enough that, and Ben, you alluded to it, people are what make the magic happen in this facility. It really, that's where it comes from. This is not programs and organization and, you know, intervention and then this therapy tool. I mean, yeah, those are all great, but the real magic happens with the people. And there's a reason why you take your time and put people through the rigors of a pretty intense interview is because you both understand how important it is to hire the right people,
right,
for this kind of program. So thank you both for what you do. Danny, I know, shout out to Danny again, and he's a lot of the magic behind this as well. We didn't take enough time to actually pick on him. We should have, but he's an amazing, amazing backbone to this entire thing. You two as well. You two do amazing work. That hurts me a little bit to say to your face, but I will tell you, you two are amazing humans, and I'm proud to call you friends. So thanks, with Brad. That, we're signing off. No One Fights Alone listeners, thank you all for tuning in. Thank you for paying attention to the growth moment, the expansion of Chateau. Stay tuned, because blink your eyes, we're going to be in a new facility.
Thanks, Brad. Appreciate you.
Thanks, Brad.
You bet. See y'all soon.
See ya.
Chateau Health and Wellness is a 16-bed treatment facility nestled in the foothills of the Wasatch Mountains in Midway, Utah. Chateau's First Responder Resiliency Program is designed to treat the unique challenges and issues that first responders encounter in the course of their careers. Chateau's comprehensive and highly individualized approach to treatment addresses more than just the presenting issues. It addresses the why. Each of their seasoned, trauma-trained, and culturally competent therapists utilize evidence-based, specialized therapies to treat trauma at its core and enable clients to begin the healing process while developing a resilient and healthy relationship with stress. Chateau Health and Wellness is trusted by departments and agencies from around the country to treat responders and veterans. In fact, it is one of only a handful of facilities nationwide that is vetted and approved to treat members of the Fraternal Order of Police. For more information or to speak to a representative, go to chateaurecovery.com or call 888-507-5031.